tonight on Arena. Edmund Duval talks to us about his new book, Letters to Common Doe, and new albums from Tom Jones, Field Music and Susan Quirk.
Up for review.
#51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. But we start this evening with The Visiting Hour, which is the latest play from Frank McGuinness. It opened online from the Gate Theatre in Dublin last night. Stephen Ray plays the character of a father whose daughter, played by Judith Ruddy, is playing her weekly visit to the nursing home where Daddy is. Chris Morrish saw last night's premiere and he's with me now. Chris, I suppose when you set a play, as Frank McGuinness has here, when you set it in a nursing home after the period of time and the experiences which we have all gone through over the past 12 to 18 months, you've chosen a pretty potent setting for your play.
Oh, you certainly have, Sean. Yeah, no, I think what we're starting to see now is we're starting to see theatre starting to process what we've been through over the past 12 months. And this is a very, very, very powerful play, and it's going to speak to a lot of people. You know, I was watching it with my wife last night, and she said, oh, that was a bit close to the bone. And I think anybody who's been in the situation of having had a relative in a nursing home over the past year will know exactly what this play is talking about, where just that sense of distance of the person you love being there on the other side of the window, you know, and at various points, you know, Stephen Ray's character will say, "You shake my hand," you know, and they can't. Very, very, very powerful piece of work.
And they can't shake hands or touch, not just because of the restrictions that would have been in place around COVID-19, but because of the way they are on the stage and the setting on the stage.
Yes, what they've done is they've sort of extended the Gate stage. So you get that kind of nostalgic hit of the Gate Theatre beforehand. You see the chandeliers and the whole setting. And actually, I noticed in the chat beforehand, you know, people were putting in things like, "Excuse me, I think you're in my seat," and, you know, all the things you'd do if you went to the Gate. Somebody said, you know, "What am I going to do if Vincent's not there to tell me to turn off my phone?" You know, Vincent, the long-serving house manager.
Yeah,
but what they've done with the set is it's just simply a bench for Judith Roddy's character, a chair for Stephen Ray's character, and a big sheet of glass between the two of them. But the effect of that is, when you film it, is you get a reflection of the person who is looking through the glass in the glass. So you get one figure superimposed over another. And it's a very, very powerful effect.
Mm. So you have both the reality of the character on stage plus this reflection in the glass panel that's between the two of them as well. In terms of, I'll come back to the filmed aspect later, but in terms of what the exchanges between them, what kind of world are we in? What kind of relationship do we see between what we're presuming is father and daughter at any rate?
Yeah, and the characters are only called father and daughter. Basically, Stephen Ray's character is suffering from, I presume, dementia. That he's confused, and he's confused about his world, and we're never quite sure a lot of what he's saying is real or not. And he talks about, you know, various people. He talks about a woman named Katie Boyle. There's a whole discussion about whether or not he was in the Eurovision, or whether he won or came second or was ever there at all. At one point, he claims to have married all three Beverly sisters. I mean, there's this whole sort of world that's there.
Yeah.
And it's funny at one level, you know, but it's funny in that way that when you're in a desperate situation, sometimes laughter is a way of coping. And I think Frank McGuinness just understands that territory so well.
Well, let's listen to a clip which speaks to exactly what you're speaking about, what you're talking about there, Chris, which is this confusion as to what is real and what is not real. And the aforementioned Katie Boyle features here. Stephen Ray as the father, Judith Roddy as daughter.
Why drag the mention of this decent woman without warning into the conversation we're having? There she goes, innocently about her business, causing no offence, harming nobody. And here's you stirring up dissent against
me. I'm doing no such thing. You are the one brought up Katie Boyle.
I do not know this lady. I cannot place her. I accuse nobody or nothing.
Who's saying you did? But you claim to have met her.
Where?
I'll let you tell me that.
Where would I have met her?
Oh, wherever it was held that year.
The song contest?
The Eurovision. Got it and won, Father.
Was that a year I won or lost? Probably came second, as usual.
Pipped at the post.
Gracious in defeat, I hope.
Impeccable behaviour, as always.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
I'm not sure what to do. So long.
So long.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
It's hard, but I'll pull through.
Stephen Ray and Judith Roddy there in a scene from The Visiting Hour, the new Frank McGuinness play, which is being performed live on the Gate Theatre, on the stage of the Gate Theatre, which is being sent out to us online tonight, in fact, starting in about 20 minutes. And I think the third performance will be tomorrow night. Chris Morrish was there, was watching last night for us. I really, even as you were telling the story before we went into that clip, and I found myself laughing at something you said, Chris, I thought, oh, maybe I shouldn't be laughing at that. And then that clip, there's parts where you're smiling, but when they sing that song in context, suddenly there's a kind of a poignancy in there. You find yourself, oh, the poor man, how lost is he? And how difficult is that for his daughter sitting there opposite him?
Yeah, and that's the kind of roller coaster of emotion that the play works with all the way through for its duration. That there are moments that are actually really quite funny, but as I say, it's humor as a way of dealing with a really impossible situation. And there's a really telling line later on in the play where Judith Roddy's character says, "If I cannot get you to make sense of what's true, then maybe I can get you to believe what defies description." She says, "Can I do that? This is my way of proving that I'm not giving up on you." And it's that playing along sometimes with Stephen Ray's character's delusions and his fantasies, and the point where the things he can remember are songs, so they join together in songs. I mean, all of these are things that anybody who has dealt with an elderly relative with dementia will recognize. But at the same time, it works. It works as theater as well. Yeah. So there's a real convergence of things there.
So obviously dementia is one of the big themes here, and the fact that the father is being visited by his daughter for this weekly hour, The Visiting Hour being the title of the play. Does it refer directly to the pandemic? Does it refer directly to any of those restrictions that would have been in place in nursing homes over the past 12 to 18 months?
Yes, it does. I mean, there's a voice comes over the tannoy system, voiced by Camilla Didnya, which basically I think four times in the play comes in and says, we would request visitors to respect the 60-minute visiting rule. So you're aware of that. But there's also a line in the play that I think, if there's one line that sums up the sadness of the past year, there's a moment where Stephen Ray's character asks, where are the people he used to know in the nursing home? And he says, I once knew people who lived here, but I do not see them these days. And he just cannot understand where the people he used to know in the nursing home are. And, like I say, if there's one line that sums up the past 12 months, that's it.
Sure. The direction here is by Katrina McLaughlin, who probably since she got this job, or before, certainly since she was given this job, she has been appointed the new artistic director of the Abbey Theatre. How did she handle this purely in terms of her direction?
I think it's beautifully directed. I think the whole piece calls for a kind of underplaying, and I think everybody does. There's a kind of barely restrained sense of frustration and sadness, but it's all just kept under. You heard that there in the clip. There's a kind of muted quality, because you don't need to blow this up. There's enough emotion there already. So I think it's very nicely done.
And I guess the fact that it's filmed, as opposed to if you were in the theatre, the projection to the back of the hall is always the big issue, when it comes to very intimate plays like this. Do we get cameras that bring us right into the actors and into the characters' minds and faces?
Yes, and it does. As I mentioned, there's this pane of glass between them, and it's highly reflective. So in a lot of shots, what you're getting is both the person, you're, the actor you're looking at, but you're also getting the reflection of the character who's doing the looking, if you like, which is a very cinematic effect. And you couldn't do that in the theater, right? You'd be on one side of the glass or the other. Having said that, this would work beautifully in a live production.
And, yeah, because in a live production, you can watch both characters. You don't need to see a reflection. Right. You that's can right. see the two of them in front of you on the stage. Yeah. You're in charge of the camera rather than a camera being in charge of the camera. What about the two performances there, the two sound? I know the voices there, that, as you mentioned, from Camila Didina, but Stephen Ray and Judith Roddy are the two. It really depends on them, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and Stephen Ray is just—he's just reached this point in his career where he just radiates presence. He can just sit there and he radiates presence. Mm. But he knows his craft so well at this point, he can just do it so effortlessly. And I think some actors reach that point in their career where they just can sometimes coast on that. But he's doing the opposite. He's becoming almost more emotionally raw as time goes on. And this is just a beautiful performance. And I mean, and Judith Roddy, I mean, it's a two-hander. There's nowhere to hide. And the ball comes back over the net with speed every time. She really plays this nicely. Very, very restrained performance. And she has one of the great scenes where she's a geography teacher. And she just simply lists a name of countries and their capitals, and she invests it with all the sorrow and the frustration and all the anxiety of what she's been going through. Just a list of countries and cities.
I guess the way that Frank McGuinness places that within the script makes that possible. It sounds as if I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but you certainly are recommending this, Chris, if I'm not putting words into your mouth.
Oh yeah, very much. I mean, I think it's going to stand up there with Frank McGuinness's best works. I think it's really a remarkable piece, and it will be something we will look back to when we're finally looking back on this horrible period of time. This is one of the pieces we'll look back to.
The Visiting Hour is the play that Chris Morrish has been speaking to us to, written by Frank McGuinness, directed by Katrina McLaughlin, starring Stephen Ray and Judith Roddy, and being performed live on the stage of the Gate Theatre and then sent out to us online. Three performances in total. The second is either underway or about to start, but I wouldn't be sending you off to that. There is another one tomorrow night. Stay with me for a while. You'll still have a final chance to see it then from your home. Get full details of how to do that on gatetheatre.ie. Almost 22 minutes past 7 on Friday night, Serena. Edmond Duval is an internationally acclaimed artist and author, best known for his large-scale installations of porcelain vessels and for The Hare with Amber Eyes, the memoir he wrote in 2010. That memoir traced his own family's Jewish European history through a collection of 264 Japanese netsuke, or small ivory figures, an heirloom handed down to him through four generations. His new book, Letters to Commando, is a kind of companion to The Hare with the Amber Eyes. It relates or tells the story, the history of Count Moyes of Commando and his family, Jewish contemporaries of Duval's own Efrusi forebears, who arrived in Paris in the same year, 1869, and who lived a few doors away. And once again, the dramatic story is told through objects. I'm delighted to have Edmond Duval join me this evening. This Count Moyes de Commando, there's a wonderful picture of him, and you have used archival material in the book, Edmund. There's a wonderful picture of him, quite a romantic kind of figure, both villainous and highly romantic, with this eye patch on his eye. What kind of a man was he?
Well, it's lovely to be able to talk about him. I mean, he was well known as a sportsman. So he was a great hunter of hounds and a great rider in the forests of outside Paris. And he, as you say, he had a black eye patch. He was very striking looking. Mm. And he loves fast cars. But most of all, he loved, absolutely adored art. I mean, that was his great passion. And he particularly loved French art of the 18th century. He comes from a great Jewish dynasty, comes from Constantinople, and arrives. And part of the great sort of tragic part of this whole story is that he tries to make himself French. He does make himself French by collecting art.
And we're here, we're in Paris in the early part, I suppose, latter part of the 19th century, and then the early part of the 20th century, La Belle Époque, essentially, is where we are in many ways. This collecting of art, it was an attempt to make himself seem very French, but it also played right in, well, he didn't think of this when he was doing it, I'm sure, it plays right into the way you tell the story, because you tell it through the works of art that still exist and are still in the house where he lived.
Well, it's the most extraordinary place. I mean, you have to imagine walking into a house that has been untouched since 1935 when he died. So he put together this house, extraordinary, beautiful house that he built, and collected all these extraordinary things, you know, tapestries and porcelain and incredible furniture and pictures, all that kind of stuff, and brings it all into a kind of sort of dream, a sort of fantasy of an 18th century house. And his will, he says, I'm leaving this to France in memory of my son. His son had died in the First World War. I'm leaving this to France on the absolute understanding that nothing must be changed, that this is a house which is a memorial. So it's a very powerful, melancholic place to wander around. And I was lucky enough to spend lots of time, you know, in the archives and the attics there and in the cellars and opening doors that haven't been opened and really exploring objects, as you point out.
And you mentioned there this idea that he handed it over to the French state, which is quite an extraordinary act, given the way not just his family, but indeed many Jewish families were treated in France in the early part. We're not into the Second World War yet. We're talking about the First World War and that period in time.
Well, that's the really... You know, this is such a painful thing, really, to be honest, because, you know, he's being this perfect citizen and bringing his family up, who he loves, his adored children, you know, and there is this roiling, terrible groundswell of anti-Semitism. I mean, just imagine opening the papers every day and seeing caricatures and seeing yourself called, you know, vulgar and nouveau riche and upstart, but also kind of more cuttingly than that, sort of impure. You know, you're being told all the time that you don't belong, that you shouldn't be there, and that you should go home. All that kind of language that we know so painfully about race.
And became something even more problematic. Problematic doesn't even define it. Became something ghastly as we get into the Second World War. Now, where does your own family, your forebears, live down the street, in fact? They were neighbours.
Exactly. I mean, it's just a normal street, really. So they live up the road, and they're all friends, and they intermarry. And so, you know, my granny, who, you know, visited there in the 1920s. These were her cousins, and they all share, you know, so many things. They share passions for music and art, and also they also very. Civic-minded. They're always looking out to kind of, you know, about how they can, you know, give something back to these countries. They're very, it's completely classic, to be honest, about first-generation immigrants, is that you're grateful and you want to prove how grateful you are to be in this new country. So it's absolutely classic.
And they were first-generation immigrants, as you say, but given the type of art collection that Count Moïse de Commandeau gathered, he did well, and many of the people in that area, they did very well. They were very successful and became very wealthy.
Well, this neighborhood is a whole extraordinary sort of network of very rich people who've come from all over the Levant and all over Europe, and Odessa in my family's case, Istanbul in his, you know, unsettled, all very near each other. And they collect and they do all these philanthropic things and they're very well off. And so, you know, they are absolutely scrutinized. Everything they do is talked about, ridiculed, vilified. And of course, you know, when I'm writing to him, I write these as letters to him because, you know, I got very close to him. I'm writing to him, and letters are a very good way of communicating with people. You can do lots of different kinds of emotional things through letters. And I'm writing to him and sort of, you know, trying to test him out, really, as a friend. You know, why is he doing this? And what does he care about, and you know, and also, you know, taking the piss sometimes out of him for some of the things I don't like in his house.
But I wondered how you had hit upon that idea of writing letters to him, and writing you address him directly. You call him many times. You refer to him as dear friend. You know, you're a little bit more respectful in some of the other letters, dear monsieur. But essentially, it is like you wanted to address him directly across the century. Why did you want to? What was it that sent you that direction? Speak directly to him.
Well, do you know what? I mean, the honest truth of that is that just over a year ago, in that lockdown, I found myself in my studio, you know, talking to him. I was walking around the studio. I didn't have any of my nice colleagues in the studio. And I was just talking aloud and I was talking to him. I mean, I'm having an exhibition there later in the year. And I know this house and I know him. You know, I really know this guy and this man. And I know his children. In all these sort of archival ways, but also in the things that he collects. And so I really wanted to talk to him about the things that matter: memory, family, you know, assimilation, all these stuff. And actually letters, you know, letters are really personal. Yeah. Mm. But also, you know, he doesn't write back. And that's the point. You know, there's a huge painful silence about that house in Paris.
Yeah, well, I suppose there's the pain of it on one aspect, and the other side is, seeing as you do make fun of him at certain times, he doesn't get a chance. He has no right of reply, unfortunately. But this idea of using the objects, I mean, it was there in The Hair with the Amber Eyes when you were telling the story of your own family through objects. You quote Virgil's phrase, lacrimae rerum, the Latin phrase for tears of things.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's for me, I've made things all my life, you know, and that's my principal thing is looking at them and handling them and caring about them. And also, you know, really thinking with some truth, I hope, about what it is to make something and pass it on, and also to be given something. Mm. And to feel that when you're given something or you encounter something, to feel the life of the person who had it before you. So the tears of things, you know, for in my own family's case, it was, you know, the destruction of my family, and yet this one collection, and then this new book, this companion book, going into that house and feeling this, you know, this, we have to talk about it, this incredible absence of what happened to his children.
Yeah, that was the bit of the book when I thought, and I was taking a breath to mention it, and I thought, I'm going to find this difficult. And thankfully, I gathered myself while you were speaking there. We see you tell him the fate of his children. You tell him the fate of many and other families on the street as well.
Indeed.
And we see identity cards. This is from the period of the Second World War. Yeah. And we all know the stories of what happened to the Jews in France during the Second World War. Seeing those objects and then you're explaining to him the fate of those people, incredibly moving to read. How difficult was it for you? And I know I'm not being facetious when I say he had become your friend at this point. Yes, how difficult was it to tell him of the fate of those people?
Do you know, it really, you have to tell it straight, and you have to hold back on being too present in telling the story. You know, you can't insert yourself too much into the story. And so I tell it to him. I say, you know, you're very exacting in the things you care about. So I'm going to be exacting and tell you how it happens. And I'm glad you mentioned those identity cards, which I illustrate in the book, because of course I start in the archive where I'm looking at all these beautiful archival things. But then in the archive are these documents, which basically are the deportation cards for his daughter, son-in-law, and his two children to the transit camp and then on to Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And so you handle these cards, you know, and you and that's the kind of touchstone of the book, because you can love all the French furniture and the porcelain and all that stuff, but when you handle those cards, you know that the story has to be told, you know, with clarity and passion, really.
Yeah, and it is done in quite that fashion, including how Goring gets his hands on some of the some of the works of art as well. That's another set of the, part of the story as well. But I wanted to finish up, Edmund, by asking about, you've mentioned the exhibition that is there. Now, this is the house that we're speaking about has been practically untouched. Nothing has been changed for so long. How come you're having an exhibition in there, and will it speak directly to the objects in the house, or what are you doing?
Well, I mean, it's really difficult because, you know, there has no been art. There's been no, it hasn't been touched since then. And I was asked because of family, because of this storytelling, to do something. And so what I'm doing really is making, you know, I make pots, I do porcelain. But to cut it, so I'm using broken objects. I'm taking in things which are damaged and repaired. There's a Japanese technique called kintsugi, where a broken object is mended with a kind of golden bit of lacquer, and it's very beautiful. And it says it's something about storytelling. It says you can't make things whole again, but you can show where fracture lies. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do that in the exhibition. I'm certainly trying to do this in the book.
I can't say about the exhibition. I can say about the book that you do manage to make the thing of beauty out of something which could be incredibly, which is incredibly difficult to tell. And thank you so much for telling us about the book and indeed the exhibition
thank
this
you
evening.
Thank you very much indeed for having me on. It's been a huge privilege. Thank you.
Edmund de Waal there speaking to us about his latest book, which is called Letters to Commando. It's published by Chatto and Windus. And so to Albert Reviews on this Friday night. First up, enjoying a career to match the likes of Leonard Cohen or Johnny Cash, octogenarian Tom Jones returns with his fourth album in a decade. It's called Surrounded by Time. Next, formed in 2004, Sunderland band Field Music, built around brothers David and Peter Bruce. Their eighth studio album is Flat White Moon. And finally, Limerick-born but now based in Lahinch, County Clare, Susan Quirk gives us her debut album, a blend of indie rock and folk. It's called Into the Sea. Eamon Sweeney and Siobhan Kane have been listening. And we will start with a man who has very little to prove after the career that he has behind him and probably in front of him as well. Here's how Tom Jones's new album opens.
And I'll drink from the sweat of your brow. I will walk to the tune of your song, but I won't crumble with you if you fall.
Tom Jones, I Won't Crumble With You If You Fall, opening track on his new album Surrounded by Time. And Siobhan Kane and Eamon Sweeney have been listening. Self-described Lazarus Man, judge on The Voice UK on Saturday nights. This is his fourth album in the last decade. 100 million album sales under his belt over his career. You know, he has nothing to prove to us. The minute I heard that, Siobhan, first thing I said to myself was Johnny Cash.
Very much. A lot of listeners will know about Johnny's beautiful work with Rick Rubin in the later part of his career. And it's funny you mention as well the Lazarus Man element, which brings us to Bowie and Black Star and his song Lazarus. So there's some lovely kind of circularity going on. But as you mentioned, 41st studio record and 80 years old from 1965 in his debut. The voice alone, it's powerful, it's pared back, and this beautiful kind of gospel song. It's a collection of songs that have meant a lot to him throughout his career. So there's a kind of reappraisal of songs, but also it's this wonderful journey through his life, I suppose.
If I could sing like that for even a half an hour at any age... 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, I'd be a very happy man. What? Where does is that voice coming from? It's extraordinary that his voice is still in such fine fettle, Eamon.
Oh, absolutely. That, and it is kind of the unique selling point and the thing that really stands out about this sometimes baffling but strangely compelling album. His voice is fantastic. There's... as Siobhan there kind of just mentioned, kind of, and I think it's very apt comparison to the whole Johnny Cash, Rick Rubin thing. I do get a sense that, you know, he's getting on in years. He's outlived the late, great Johnny Cash. I do get a sense, you know, Tom Jones, we know and love Delilah, What's New Pussycat, yeah. The Green, Green Grass at Home. But with the exception maybe of the Green, Green Grass of Home, the 1967 album that that single is from, he's not exactly a guy that has, you know, a Sgt. Pepper or a Bob Dylan Blood in the Tracks and so on. So I really get a real sense that he's kind of going out on a limb here and giving it a good old go.
It, you know, interesting though, in the midst of that detail that he was giving us there, Siobhan, Eamon mentioned the word a sometimes baffling album. I suppose, is that in, for, was it, what, did it baffle you in places? And if so, in what way?
Well, I love creepy electronics. And the first song that you opened with, I Won't Crumble With You If You Fall, has a bit of that there. I mean, something that, but I still think it worked, where something like The Windmills of Your Mind, which a lot of Noel Harrison's song that then Dusty Springfield just, you know, made so majestic. That for me doesn't work as well, but it's one of the few minor notes on something that I think is kind of major, because as Eamon mentioned there, he is going a bit out on a limb. I think Ethan Johns, when you mentioned four records in a decade, the son of Glyn Johns, who worked with the Zep and the Beatles and so on, great lineage. He has been a great collaborator for Jones, I think, because this is the fourth outing for the two of them. And there's a kind of, not a foil, but he knows what to do with Tom's voice, but also brings in these other weird, there's a song called Mother Earth, which is kind of this folk song, but it kind of brings elements of trip-hop and cinematic orchestra and just less obvious elements that kind of do something quite magic.
And then there are songs like this.
Of course, radio reported we'd all ignore it. Paper said we'd have no time for it. But before you knew it, you knew Milton Berle. And we all had a new escape from the world. All tuned in before too soon. We were watching a man walk on the moon. He made it look as easy as driving a car. Video killed the radio star.
There we go, talking reality blues. Television, reality television blues from Tom Jones and his new album Surrounded by Time. Did that one baffle you or what did it do for you, Eamon Sweeney?
I actually thought, the first time I heard that, I was going, hang on, is this that guitar? Is that Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead? What's going on? This sounds like something from Amnesiac, or I might be wrong, by Radiohead. And then Tom Jones starts talking. And it's like, okay. And as we just, you know, heard a snippet there, but he goes on to go on, you know, he's talking about the moon landings, the advent of colour television, the advent of MTV, Michael Jackson, up and to reality TV and Donald Trump. Now, by the way, it is a cover version by an American all-country singer by Todd Snyder. But the whole thing was just like going, what on earth is going on here?
So we've been singing the praise of his voices and you've used the word baffling. Give me your stars, Eamon. I'll stick with you just for stars. And are there bits of the album that maybe it's an hour and a minute long? I did think a little trim wouldn't. I always think anything over an hour now, you want to be earning it.
Yeah, I do think, you know, for all its good intentions, and I think it's a solid record, the version of the Waterboys, This Is the Sea, is really a low point. But funny enough, some people have been singing its praises. He really hams it up there. I think it's kind of very unnecessary.
So stars from you then?
Three stars.
Three. And what are you saying overall? Maybe things that you've told us what worked, something that didn't work for you, and stars, Siobhan?
I would say I kind of think maybe The Windmills of Your Mind was the low point for me. I actually liked This Is the Sea, but I also liked the Michael Kiwanuka cover of I Won't Lie, which actually Ethan Johns produced that song as well on Home Again for Michael. So I give it an actual strong four.
A strong four from you. And that is Surrounded by Time. Very apt title as well from Tom Jones. He's 81 in June the 7th. He's 81. There you go. Tom Jones, Surrounded by Time. The title of the new album. Let's move on to Field Music and Flat White Moon. Here's a track called Out of the Frame. Well, you know,
show yourself.
Out of the Frame from Field Music and their new album Flat White Moon, which sounds like some kind of a coffee to me, Siobhan. Siobhan, I suppose we're talking ostensibly here about the Brewis brothers, David and Peter.
Yes.
They say that this album is inspired by their parents' record collection. So what did the parents have in their on the shelves? And can you hear it all over the songs, well, the 12 songs of the album?
Well, it's funny. There's a kind of nice dovetailing with Tom Jones in a way in terms of little elements of the Zep and the Beatles. But then they also went back to their older influences for themselves as when they were growing up as teenagers. And I think a lot of us in lockdown have been bringing ourselves back to things that bring comfort. So it was Beck and De La Soul. And so there's this lovely mingling of kind of hazy 1970s mixed with then kind of 3 Feet and Rising by De La Soul. And again, as usual with the Brewis brothers, their wonky universe, some things just don't seem to go together, but they absolutely do. It's kind of Prefab Sprout meets Prince.
Yeah, there were a couple of tracks. Now, we did an item on Prince up the 5th anniversary earlier in the week, and I thought, is this why I'm hearing Prince in about 3 or 4 of these tracks? But it certainly did hear Prince over a few of them. They tell us, Eamon, or well, David Brewis tells us at any rate about Flat White Moon. He says, we want to make people feel good about the things that we feel terrible about. I'm not sure if I fully follow that statement, but what kind of things are they talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, this was a difficult record for the brothers to do because they lost their mother.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
This is a kind of a theme to it, and their parents' record collections. Mm. They mentioned stuff like Led Zeppelin and Free. It's very much more like, I think, in the vein, Prince there, as Siobhan pointed out, and De La Soul, Beck Odelay, I think, would be a reference point as well. Talking Heads, Dirty Projectors.
And the Beatles, there's a song that it's not the same sound as Obladi Blada, but Not When You're In Love is the same. It's kind of telling the love story of a young couple, and then they go up, you know, it's kind of the same story, really, isn't it?
There's another track called When You Last Heard From Linda, which is so Beatlesque. It's like, you know, almost too much so, I think. I like the premise of the album.
The premise, explain that.
The premise of kind of, you know, mining their kind of
the parents,
their youth and the rest of the parents. To be honest, I'm not really down with that Sunderland sound, Maximo Park, Future Heads, who've also been very much kind of part of a collective with the brothers over the years. The vocal for me lets the side down. It's a bit bland.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to a track called Invisible Days, 10th track on the album of 12 track album. There you go. A track that starts with the word she, and then George Martin obviously suggested to them that they use the cello along the way there in the middle of that track. Invisible Days from Field Music and Flat White Moon. Yeah, the Beatles are all over that track. Mm. But kind of a, I hate the word quirky. I can't believe I'm using it. But there's a kind of a quirky feel to that guitar arrangement, Eamon.
Yeah, quirky and jerky. all the quirks. The music itself, I don't mind. As I just already said, I'm not mad about the vocal. The arrangements are, as we just heard, stuff we've all heard before in places it's done well. I think the only track that really, you know, kind of does what it says in the tin would be Do Yourself a Favour, which is a really strong single, but the rest of it just doesn't quite wash me.
All right, well now, when you don't mind an album, how does that translate into stars, Eamon?
Two and a half.
I think you're a little bit more positive on this one, Siobhan.
I am, because their song Orion from the Streets mingles Studio Ghibli, Cary Grant and loads of wine. So on that basis, I'm giving them a different kind of four that I gave to Tom Jones, but a four nonetheless.
A different kind of four for Flat White Moon from Field Music. Let's move on then to local artist Susan Quirk, born in Limerick but now living in, or based in Lahinch in County Clare. Just went down the road a little bit, didn't she? Here's the title track from the album Into the Sea. She knows peace as she breathes in light. That is the title track, Into the Sea, from Susan Quirk and her debut album. An album written between Clare and California and 10 years in the making. And tell us a little bit more about her. Lots of very well-known Irish musicians involved on this album. But tell us a little bit more about her, Siobhan.
Yes, Susan had felt, you know, very musical growing up, and a turning point was the death of a very close friend who'd really always believed in her talent. So she's talked about this taking, you know, a decade has gone into the making of this, and there are people like Colm Kearney on guitar, Robbie Malone on bass, and you've got the wonderful Colin McInimmer on violin, which for me, his collaboration and contribution is this wonderful kind of underlying good presence to this. So she's put in a lot. The sea is a metaphor for her throughout the whole record in terms of transformation, the idea of comfort and resilience as well. And so she, the places she wrote the record in were all beside the sea, whether it was Clare, Dublin or Northern California.
Yeah, and do you hear both influences there, Eamon? First of all, Clare and California, and well, I suppose the Dublin side of things as well, because she has a fascinating working life outside of her music.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. She works as a meditation teacher and a social entrepreneur, and she's been very successful at it. And Dash is also, she's in combining that work with the music now that she's kind of spent a decade kind of really crafting this. It's opened doors for her that wouldn't open, I think, probably necessarily for other musicians. She's played for the Dalai Lama and President Michael D. Higgins, which in itself is very impressive, in addition to, you know, your Electric Picnics and Bodied In Souls and so on. And yeah, as Siobhan mentioned, that this, it kind of is the metaphor of the sea of consciousness. And I imagine it's something that really kind of taps into her other career as a meditation teacher, because she's talking about reclamation of personal power, healing, transformation, perseverance during hard times, resilience, power, community. Indeed, there's stuff like the global refugee crisis, our connection with nature or lack of connection with it, cultivating peace of mind, alchemizing fear into love, all this kind of stuff that she kind of brings through it, which I think is really impressive. I did find it took a listener or two for me to really come home. Right. Initially, maybe I approached something like this going, oh, this is a bit too maybe folk rock for my tastes. But it grew on me.
Yeah. Right. Let's have a quick listen to a bit of a track called To the Bone. I just wanted to get a sense of her voice in a different style there, Siobhan, that kind of more of a folky style. Does this album work overall for you, Susan Quirk's Into the Sea and Stars to finish up,
yes,
Siobhan?
Yes, I think it was actually quite immersive. After a few listens, the first song you played, Into the Sea, reminded me a lot of Mazzy Star's Fade Into You, and there's a little element of Laura Veers, and she has a very dusky quality to her voice, which is really quite beautiful. So I thought of something like Cat Power on the record Sun and Cherokee. So there's some lovely bluesy elements, and then it took me in lots of interesting places. So I'd give that a 3.5, which I know seems bad because I've given now 2 4s. I'm just very interested to know where might take this next.
3.5. And just Stars from you, Eamon?
I'd go 3.5 as well. Or 3.5.
3.5.
Is it 3.5 or 3.5?
I think 3.5, Eamon. I take 3.5.
You can go and work out your bats and decimals fractions. 3.5 and 3.5 are the same, children. Thank you very much for paying attention in class this evening. That's Eamon Sweeney and Siobhan Cain speaking to us about Susan Quirk's Into the Sea, Flat White Moon from Field Music, and Surrounded by Time from Tom Jones. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy, the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Have a great weekend. Speak to you on Monday at 7.